We're back. It's Mike, Mike, and Oscar. Do you know where your children are?
Yeah, parents, beware of this movie. Then again, we want to hear from parents on this movie. We don't have kids of our own.
And we don't want to hear from kids about this movie.
No, we don't want to hear the kids. Kids should not watch this movie. But parents, tell us your feedback.
We're doing the Florida Project today. It's the Oscar Sprint profile of the Florida Project, the film that really rides and dies this award season on the back of Willem Dafoe's chances for the Best Supporting Actor Oscar. We're going to get into that and a lot more about the plots, twists and turns. Just overall thoughts before we get started here.
One of those independent movies that just screams indie spirit of awards and screams just the overall independent spirit as a philosophical concept. And this kind of makes you feel artsy or extra fartsy. I don't know which.
And angry. Make me feel very angry. But we'll get into all that. We're doing the Florida Project. Just real quick, as we always do, or we try to always do at the top and bottom of every episode. We love doing this stuff for the Oscar Sprint Profile. We're trying to get you ready for award season. The Golden Globes are now solely in the rearview mirror. So we are on our way to Oscar Sunday. And if we want to hear from you guys, any comments, questions, concerns, any thoughts about the Oscar Sprint Profiles we've had, or any thoughts about where we should go next, reach out to us. We love hearing from you. We are Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook, Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram, MMO_pod on Twitter, and we are Mike, Mike, and Oscar @gmail.com. Reach out to us. We love hearing from you guys. We love talking back to you. We try to make sure we respond to every comment we get.
We started out with some retrospectives on Oscars past. We started out with some year in review pods. We reviewed the summer in our first episode. We reviewed the Netflix originals in our most listen to episode till now, and we are now going after each one of these Oscar contenders in their own pod. I think we're doing it in a way that's on demand for you, where you can easily avoid spoilers, and we're the podcast you never knew you always wanted. So, you know, we're having a blast, and
we don't like patting ourselves on the back, but we're the greatest thing in the history of the world. Yeah, we firmly believe. No. We thank you for coming along. You know, if you want to spread the word, we'd appreciate that. But we're trying to put out good content for you guys. And we mean it when we say it. Reality sucks, so why not just keep watching movies with us? But let's get into the Florida Project, one of the ones that's far too harsh reality for too many people, type of setup. But Mike usually leads us off with the production profile. But today we're going to start, as we did with the, was it I, Tonya?
I, Tonya, I went with cast and crew first, and I'm going to do the same thing again. Just to give you a sense of the people involved, directed and co-written by Sean Baker from a screenplay, also by Baker and Bergotch.
Yeah, I was going to say, can you say, give that to me again?
Bergotch. Baker's filmography includes...
Thank God we're just Mike. You know, we're murdering all these names throughout this podcast. We apologize.
Baker's filmography includes tiny independent movies like Four Letter Words, Take Out, Prince of Broadway, Starlet, and last year's Tangerine. I'm horrified to say that I haven't watched any of those films.
Another filmmaker I was not familiar with, and happy to see his work.
Right, even though Tangerine got a ton of press and award season buzz last year, it was notoriously shot on an iPhone, the entire thing. So this guy is a... bit of a savant as a filmmaker.
Somebody else with more talent than us.
The Florida Project stars Willem Dafoe as Bobby, the Holiday Inn manager. I don't know.
Yes, he's chingy in this movie is what he is.
He was born in Appleton, Wisconsin, one of eight children raised, as he says, by his five sisters because his mother was a nurse and his father was a surgeon. They were super busy, loving parents, but super duper busy. The family ancestry is German, English, Irish, Scottish, French, and Goblin. He got his nickname. What?
Perfect.
He got his nickname of Willem in high school from William being his real name. His friends, just for whatever reason, couldn't speak good English. I don't know, but they call him Willem. Dafoe served the door.
You're telling me his real first name is William? I've been lied to by him all these years.
It's a stage name, I guess. Dafoe served the Dark Lord Sauron and studied drama at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, but he left after three semesters to track some hobbits and join an experimental acting group called Theater X, which somehow morphs into the Worcester group which he acts with all the way into the 2000s, despite his stardom. So that's kind of interesting. Defoe's movie career began when he was cast and cut from the epic flop Heaven's Gate. A year later, he starred as the leader of a motorcycle group in The Loveless, and he played another role like that in Streets of Fire in 1984.
Heaven's Gate is a very interesting rabbit hole that you can lose time on the internet and finding out what the effect that movie had on its production and its company. And
Deer Hunter director, right?
Yeah, that sounds right. We're not a movie podcast, thank God, so we don't need those that kind of information.
Defoe broke out in 1985 with To Live and Die in L.A., where he plays a murderous counterfeiter and villain to the CIA agent hero, CIA man, William Peterson. At the end of the 80s, Defoe was considered for the role of the Joker that Jack Nicholson eventually got in.
It would have been an interesting Joker.
Tim Burton's.
I can see that.
1989 Batman. He might have been too scary. I don't know.
He would have been terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
And it was after that that Defoe was quoted to say he didn't want to get typecast, and he deliberately decided to mix it up from then on. He played a soldier in Platoon, one of the first of these choices, and it nominated him for his first Best Supporting Actor Oscar. His next nomination would come with the bizarre and wonderful role, my favorite all-time Willem Dafoe role, as Nosferatu in Shadow of the Vampire in 2001. Defoe has some unique perspectives on his characters. He says, "I think all characters live in you. You just frame them, give them circumstances, and that character will happen," unquote.
Yeah, that's something easy to be said by a very talented actor.
Well, it's kind of literal in the terms of he starred in The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
No, that's a terrible religious jokes for some
people. Gotta be one of the only people that's played both Jesus and the devil at various points throughout his career.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
That's a good point.
He's God is what he is. That's what I'm saying.
The rest of his 80s include Mississippi Burning.
I get struck by a lightning. Sitting.
Born on the 4th of July. Other highlight. Crybaby, the David Lynch berserker of a film that is Wild at Heart. Tom and Viv, Clear and Present Danger, The English Patient, Victory, Affliction, Existenz, and The Boondock Saints are his many highlights from the 1990s.
One of your favorites.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of Boondock Saints. However, I love his performance in that one.
He's very good.
He's awesome
good.
In that.
Also, you're wrong about the Boondock Saints, but that's a different podcast.
A lot of people say that. His early 2000s...
Send your hate mail to...
His early 2000s were incredible, and I'm not wrong about this next movie, one of my all-time favorite horror comedies, American Psycho. Came in 2000. Spider-Man, Finding Nemo, The Life Aquatic, and The Aviator were done in his next 5 years in the early 2000s. The last 15 years, he's been a voice in lots of animated movies, including anime Fireflies in the Garden. I believe that's Studio Ghibli. The Fantastic Mr. Fox for Wes Anderson, another anime movie, Tales of Earthsea, and of course, the Finding Nemo and Finding Dory sequels. Been the character actor. The quintessential character actor in a lot of big blockbuster movies and a lot of small movies and a lot of beloved movies. The Spider-Man sequels, Triple X, John Carter, Speed 2, Cruise Control, some of his blockbusters. He also has done the explosively controversial performance over the past 15 years, like the Lars von Trier films, Antichrist and Nymphomaniac.
Yep.
Go-Go Tales and the Boondock Saints, two other smaller movies that have fit into the box of kind of being somewhat controversial as well.
Not a guy that's afraid to take any kind of role. I mean, controversy, blockbuster, he's just looking for a good, solid character, and he plays the shit out of him.
Yeah, he's been in great movies, and some of those other notable performances from his last 15 years are Spike Lee's Inside Man, The Hunter, Out of the Furnace, The Fault in Our Stars, John Wick, this year's What Happened to Monday, this year's Death Note, this year's Murder on the Orient Express, and he is set to star in next year's Aquaman, starring Vincent Chase, and at Eternity's Gate in 2018.
Would have been, I'd like to see his character in Antichrist be played in The Fault in Our Stars. Just mix those two worlds,
Dear
have
Jesus.
It be part of the same universe.
The rest of the cast of the Florida Project.
I have cancer. Oh my God!
Pull your pants up! The rest of the cast of the Florida Project includes Brooklyn Prince, who plays a 6-year-old Mooney.
She blew me away.
She's great. Bria Venita. That's the correct pronunciation, too. Bria Venita.
You're having a lot of fun playing that. You want to say that one more time?
I like the band Electric Six. Venita. Nobody else.
Your brother is clapping and nodding his head solely.
Bria Venita plays Mooney's mom, Haley or Hallie. Valeria Cotto is the little girl, Jancy, and Jodie Olivo is her grandma. Aiden Malik is the little boy, Dickie, and his mom, Ashley, is played by Mayla Murder. Quite the stage name there.
It's murder! Not to jump ahead into the performances section, but we always talk about on this how, you know, films that rely on children are going to live and die by the child actors' performances. And,
right.
And for me, that Brooklyn Pierce, what her portrayal was of Mooney, I was enthralled. I thought she did a great job.
It's amazing how you take a whole film and just rest it on the shoulders of somebody so young,
yeah,
and so inexperienced. She's only been in like Robo Chicken, the movie, or, you know, Robo Dog. I think it was called Robo Dog, and that's the only other thing she's ever been in. Maybe one other little kids movie. So yeah, I mean, she crushes it here. Willem Dafoe again is the motel manager.
Handyman Jesus,
and his son is played by Caleb Landry Jones, who just might be in everything.
I think he's in every movie. I think he's just decided he's going to have a role in every movie.
Three Billboards, the ad agency guy, the brother in Get Out,
back up to Ben Roethlisberger in Pittsburgh.
to jump into the story inception, Baker actually wanted to make this film before Tangerine back in 2011. He went to a company called CineReach, and they gave him a grant to both scout the locations and begin his research. So I guess if you're established, you can get grants to kind of start your indie project. The title, The Florida Project, refers to what the Disney Corporation called the buying of all this land that they eventually, made
into mouse ears on it. Yeah,
Disney World there. Sean Baker says this film is like a version of The Little Rascals.
He's wrong.
He used to watch the syndicated show when he was a kid. He came home from school every day, and they would play it in blocks. The Little Rascals, of course, was set against the Great Depression, and he thought it was a beautiful way of, you know, showing that kids don't necessarily, you know, realize the poverty they're in. They're just kids, and he wanted to focus this story just on the kids more than the poverty as well.
Yeah, I joke about saying that he's wrong, and obviously he's the creator, but there are similarities to that just hopeful naivety or naivete that, you know, young people have, and they don't understand their surroundings. They don't understand how good or bad they have it, so you can see some similarities, sure.
Ignorance is kind of bliss. And
that's how I live my life.
Bria Venita was cast via Instagram. That's correct. Baker,
where we're going, huh?
Found her on Instagram one day, Bria tells it. She opened her DMs, and there was a long note from Sean Baker saying, "I would like to tell you about this unique film opportunity." She thought it was a joke, but the message was so well written.
You just gave a bunch of creepy dudes a whole new way to open up conversations.
Oh, no. Well, the email was so well written that she told herself she would go along with the joke if it, in fact, was one. So she found out that it wasn't. They flew her out.
Lucky for her. It's a legit opportunity.
Right? They flew her out to Florida. She read the script and cried while reading it. She was actually a very well-read and well-written, or somewhat, I don't know her education, actually, but she's a well-read person by all accounts. By her,
that's fine. We don't have any ourselves. So.
No. We don't read books. Mayla Murder, Ashley, emphatically said that these families really exist, and that's something I really want to talk about in the production profile today, because the movie is made on the subject of the silent homeless. Sean also said that this is not just a Florida problem, it's a nationwide problem. These are technically homeless people that cannot be approved for longer-term housing, and they're stuck with these $35, $40 a day motels. Bria Venita brought up a great point on a talk show saying that these prices, if you add them up, obviously, they come out to around $1,000 a month. So these people are kind of getting screwed in that they can't afford first and last month's rent before they go into any agreement. Then again, on the flip side, the Dafoe character is based on a real person, a single real person.
Jesus Christ.
That they interviewed. They thought that this motel manager was both compassionate to his residents, but he also needed to remain professional in order to keep his business, which is really a struggling and a failing business, going.
Yeah, don't fool yourselves. I mean, this is on the outskirts of Disney for a reason, but this is not in any way a Disney happy-go-lucky, oh, everything's going to work out in the end movie.
Right. They actually met this person. This is Sean Baker and company. They met this guy while on a location scout, and they were kind of just watching kids playing at a motel, and they were just watching how the kids were playing wiffle ball. They were watching how the kids were just going nuts on the outside of this motel during a Florida summer. And the motel manager, this guy comes out at them with, like, they don't remember what the weapon was, but they think it was like a drill. And he looked extremely threatening. And he confronts them. He brings them all into his office and interrogates them for a while. Apparently, Andrew Garfield and Michael Shannon had stayed there a while back while they were filming the movie 99 Homes, which I saw and was kind of underwhelming. But anyway, they were doing research for 99 Homes, and they knew some of the same people that Sean Baker and company knew. So when the motel manager was kind of mentioning some of the other of the producers that were there, Sean Baker actually had those people text the hotel manager and tell them who they were and kind of vouch for them. Next thing Baker knows, he's having
dinner.
Like
the Hollywood elite having to suck up to a motel manager.
Well, the independent film elite for sure there. And next thing Baker knows, he's having dinner with the guy at the guy's home.
Really cool.
So the movie, again, is about the silent homeless, even though the film doesn't mire in that kind of depression necessarily. Like we said, it is, whether you agree with it or not, it is a bit of a Little Rascals version of that,
I would say.
Yeah,
it has its moments.
But this is a real problem, like we said. It's a nationwide problem. Baker mentions this one charity throughout his promotional work, and I do want to give them a shout-out here. I went to their website. It's legit. Hope192.com. Again, that's hope192.com.
It is the numbers 192?
Yes, 192. Hope192.com is a Kissimmee, Florida organization, and it's trying to help a lot of the people in this specific area. If you want to donate to that cause, obviously it's a great cause to donate to. He's been touting it up pretty well.
And it's interesting that he put in the movie how intricate to the daily lives that, you know, charity is to these people. There's the scenes where there's church groups or other charities giving, this is how these people survive. They give them the sustenance and the food they need at certain points to
essential.
Kind of make it through. Yeah.
It's essential.
God bless them.
Now, in terms of production notes, it was a tight shoot. They didn't have the kids for long hours like you never do. It was a shoot where they improvised a lot, and that's really good for, you know, non-actors.
Mm-hmm.
The cranes, the animal life, those shots were, and those scenes were entirely improvised. In terms of the cranes, the director actually hurried the cameras and Willem Dafoe outside in order to get that shot. And the producers were in his ear. They were yelling at him, like, you can't do this. Those things are in danger.
Right.
If, you know, we can get kicked out and shut down.
Yeah.
I mean, I
can't speak to the endangered wildlife, but I know, you know, I vacation in Maine, and they take, you know, the seagrass is all. And if you step on it, you're going to get yelled at from someone that wasn't even there 2 seconds ago. Swoop in and call you. But just to provide context, there's a scene where Willem Dafoe is opening up the motel for the morning, and there's just a couple of cranes hanging out in front of his front door. So he goes out just to shoo them away.
Yeah, I mean, Sean Baker just
apparently wasn't scripted.
Walk out of the motel lobby and just say anything in action. that's how he got a laugh.
That's cool. Yeah, it's cool. It provided a good, you know, angle to let you know you're in Florida.
Sure. Got a laugh from the film festival audiences as well. Now, Brooklyn Prince, again, she's the 6-year-old actress starring in the movie. Her crying scene came up, and she was just having fun talking to her friends on set, like before she was about to film this thing. And she told the, you know, her acting coach. The acting coach was like another director on this movie. She was involved in all the promotional videos, and I'm sorry, I forgot her name. I didn't write it down. I'm a jerk. But she was really interesting to listen to, and she told her that, listen, if you can't cry, we're gonna have to put drops in your eyes. And the kid freaked out about that fact. She didn't want drops in her eyes, and it seemed to scare her into just that.
She's
amazing,
like Rachel from Friends. Yeah,
amazing turn on a scene. So after the scene finished, like 20 crew members, they were crying during the shooting of it, and they all like came and hugged the little girl one after another after a shot, and it was this big, you know, just this big thing after it.
So Brooklyn Prince is as manipulative about her emotions as Mooney was in the movie. That's good to know.
Exactly. Because of all the kids on set, Baker did outlaw profanity when the camera, even when it was not rolling, even though when it was rolling.
What the hell what good does that do?
Little nugget.
It's all kinds of curse words and profanity in every scene.
But dude, I would love to see Baker get his hands on some more money to make his movies in the future. This guy is extremely innovative. It's undeniable his filmmaking talent. And I, even though I want to see him continue to do indie movies. Like, I would hate to see him, like, just jump into a superhero movie franchise or something like that.
Get a story. Keep stories going.
No question. He's a talented filmmaker. It's also an important movie, I would say. Baker did screen the film to Congress. I don't know how that's going, but...
I'm sure they took it to heart.
Well, he did.
With a straight face.
There is some politics in this movie that you can't deny, even though it's... Well, I don't know. It might be apolitical, but it's about an issue, no question.
Yeah, there's certainly... I found a political undertone, and we'll get that I think is undeniable. But
so you got the specs, Mike?
Yeah, let's talk about specs in the Florida Project. So, like Mike said, it was written and directed by Sean Baker, also written by Chris Bergach, I believe is his name. I could be mispronouncing that like Mike did. Who knows? We're terrible
Bergach.
People.
Bergach?
Debuted May 22nd at Cannes, and went wide in the U.S. on October 6th. A 109-minute runtime film distributed by, guess who? A24. What a year they're having. $2 million budget, which I think is the lowest budget of any Oscar sprint profile.
Minuscule.
Film we've done. Yeah. Depending on what you believe, it's grossed either $6.3 million according to Wikipedia, or it's grossed $5.3 million according to Box Office Mojo. If you go with the 5.3 number and you go with Box Office Mojo stats, it would make it the 144th highest domestic grossing film of 2017.
It's still in 229 theaters. It's kind of hard. It's kind of lingering right now, but it's kind of hard to find.
It's not... My next part is going to be about critical reception, but it's getting critically received well, but it's not having the same momentum that I would say a Lady Bird does, or something like that.
92 Metacritic.
Yeah. Not quite as high as Lady Bird in terms of critic adulation. It also doesn't have the momentum, like I said, but it certainly is one of the best received films of the year. 8.0 IMDb rating on 9,300 plus reviews. 96% certified fresh Rotten Tomato rating on 223 critic reviews with an average of 8.8 out of 10.
Yes, that's high.
Yes, very high. Audience score 79% on 9,500 plus reviews on Rotten Tomatoes with an average of 3.9 out of 5. Like Mike just told you, a 92 Meta rating from Metacritic. Quick point about my Metacritic stats. I realized I wasn't clicking a tab, so I've been giving kind of skewed information, which is my fault. The Lady Bird scare, I said it was the second highest of the year. It still might have been, but I was only looking at the past 90 days. Dunkirk also had a 94, which I think was the same one as Lady Bird, so it's tied. Just want to get that out there. But but the 92 Metacritic rating that this film had tied it for sixth for all 2017 releases, only 3 points behind number one film Faces Places, 2 points behind A Fantastic Woman, Dunkirk, and Lady Bird, 1 point behind Call Me By Your Name, and it was tied with Foxtrot, also placing itself a point ahead of the Phantom Thread movie and 5 points ahead of Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Just to give you a kind of full picture and a little context.
You can definitely tell who the critical darlings are.
And I think once we get into the Gold Derby stat, you're going to hear at least one category is kind of getting enraptured with all the success that this film has.
Right.
The awards profile, to get into it, this is William Dafoe's Oscar... Willem, I will not call him William. This is Willem Dafoe's Oscar vehicle. We're reviewing this for the Willem Dafoe. He's getting, whether rightly or wrongly, as much praise for his performance in this film as I had Venom for his turn in Netflix's Death Note. So good for him. One Golden Globe nomination, one SAG nomination as well for Dafoe, 3 Critics' Choice nominations, Best Young Actor or Actress for Brooklyn Prince, Best Supporting Actor Dafoe, and Best Picture. Finished on the AFI Top 10 list for Best Top 10 Films of 2017. Dafoe is the show stealer as far as awards go. He has 19 circuit wins to his name for the Supporting Actor category, including such biggies as the National Board of Review and LAFCA, the LA Film Critics Association Awards. But don't step on this film's Best Picture chances. It probably isn't going to be a winner for the Best Picture at the Oscars, but I would be surprised to not see it nominated. It has finished with the top 10 in the category of Best Picture at prestigious critic circles such as the Dallas-Fort Worth Film Critics Association, where it finished 9th, Las Vegas Film Critics Society Awards, where it finished 2nd, and as stated before, it has a nomination for the Critics' Choice among the top 10 films of the year for the Critics' Choice Awards.
Yeah, the supporting actor wins for Dafoe on the lead up here. His list of wins so far is like a list of all the biggest cities in our country, pretty much.
Yeah, cities that exist. Yeah.
He's quite the favorite so far in terms of the critics' eyes, that's for sure.
I can't believe he's getting nominated for this and not his role as the Green Goblin. Mike's going to tell you about some Gold Derby stats that we have on this.
22 out of the 29 experts on Gold Derby have it up for Best Picture, so that was high.
Yeah, there you go.
Only one for 29 have Sean Baker in their top 5 for Best Director.
It's such a loaded year for director. It's tough to break in there.
28 out of 29 have Willem Dafoe up for Best Supporting Actor, and 13 of them have him in first place.
So we're talking pretty much every other critic is picking him.
Only one out of 27 have it up for Best Cinematography. The Florida Project is a front runner in Feinberg Forecast's Best Picture, Director, and Supporting Actor categories. That seems like a long shot in terms of director if you contrast it with these other critics, but Feinberg knows something. He's usually right. He's got a high percentage.
It wouldn't shock me, but I mean, you know, there's so much backlash against Gerwig not getting a Golden Globe nomination, or any woman for that matter. You know, Jordan Peele you would think is going to get one. Spielberg is making The Post. He's going to probably be in there. It's tough to find your way into one of those five seats for the directors.
You got beautiful new voices. You got old standbys like Spielberg and Ridley Scott. And then you got wild cards like Paul Thomas Anderson, mm-hmm. who could still fit in. You got Academy favorites throughout the field. It's loaded. Feinberg has The Florida Project as a major threat for supporting actress, believe it or not, Bria Venaita, an original screenplay. I was surprised to see that because Bria Venaita is not winning a whole bunch of stuff out there.
Not getting, not that I saw at least on the awards, not a whole lot of love for her, but good, fine performance. I mean, it's believable playing a role that she had for basically a new neophyte Hollywood starlet. Mm. All right, so let's get into the expectations for this movie. What did you have going in here, Mike?
You know, I knew about Tangerine, but like I said, I hadn't seen it. I knew it was going to be a monster performance, or I thought it was going to be a monster performance from Willem Dafoe. So I actually came away super impressed with Baker, the director. You know, it's again, this is like dollar for dollar, an amazing accomplishment that he could, for $2 million, produce this piece of art.
Just quality, yeah.
But I was a bit underwhelmed by Dafoe's performance, and I had probably absurdly high expectations. I've seen him in better roles, I feel. A dozen roles
such
at least over
Goblin.
His career,
because
he's just been such a great actor. I mean, there's nothing wrong with this performance. It's extremely well done. We're going to get into the ins and outs of it. But
the lack of Spider-Man for me.
That was a teaser for my review. How about you?
I was expecting another, you know, one of these true to life, another sad tale of a portrait of everyday life of the less fortunate, and boy was I wrong. I was so very, very, very wrong. I wasn't expecting to be as sad and angry as I was at the end of this. I knew it was a kind of a depressing film. It's for me at least, this is a film that definitely left an indelible mark, and we'll get into it.
So sound to sight with the production values, I think.
Celebrate
Cool
in
the Gang
dance,
celebration
on.
The Obama campaign
what
song.
A fucking What a shitty thing to do to the audience to start off on that note.
It kind of fits the time of this story in the sense that President Obama got into office at the end of the housing crisis, which caused this problem of the silent homeless, and his campaign song opens up the film.
Oh,
there's
God.
No music throughout the rest of the movie other than
at the very end.
The music that the people play on their phones, that the characters play on their phones. And then, of course, the last sequence, there's like a score involved there. So there's not a lot to say in terms of the sound. I want to get right into the visuals. And on this budget, in this setting, to make it look like a paradise like it does at times.
Yeah, and you said it could be, you know, it's getting a little recognition for cinematography. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I was kind of going into this, I didn't expect to get such elaborate shots. But there's one shot where the power goes out in the motel complex, and then you're given a wide angle of the shit-talking as Willem Dafoe's character goes to fix the power, and everybody's out on their balcony yelling at him.
Yes.
He fixes the power, and he comes back out, and you got the wide angle shot, everyone cheering him on.
I love the camera angles in this movie. They do it almost up and over the kids' shoulders at times.
Yeah.
So really put you in their POV.
Literally give you their POV, yeah.
So and it's just gorgeous to look at. I can't get over that you have this little budget and you're making a movie with such an aesthetic. So the production design and the cinematography deserve like every independent film award that there is. I don't necessarily know if you stack it up with Dunkirk and the IMAX.
No, you don't. But I mean, something with like the Gotham Awards, where those are specially made for movies with only a $10 million or $20 million under budget.
Right.
I could definitely see, you know, it making headwaves there. It was also talking about sight, the use of the wide angle shots too. I mean, in reality, the kids are probably crossing the street, but he uses such a far away look that the sense is that these kids are going on an adventure in their minds.
Right.
And it's shot as if it's an adventure film. They're traversing these long roads and highways to go get an ice cream, you know? I mean, it was really well done.
And the ice cream shop is just like this giant ice cream, and then there's, right? It's like the giant donut in L.A. atop the, and then they go past the giant orange.
The big
place.
Orange,
They go past the place with the giant wizard on the front, like the gift
it's
shop.
It's like, that's how, it's like they're going to Mordor.
It's like they're in Candyland, they're in this fantasy land, like you said. It's amazing that they have all this real-life stuff to shoot.
That's what the point I was going to bring up. I wonder how much of it was even brought in, especially for the movie, or if these places just exist down in Florida. As far as cinematography goes, it's such a small budget, so they couldn't have done much with props and especially made things for the film. But if you have this fantasy land down there already built for you, why not shoot it?
Slash Film and Award Circuit, those podcasts seem to say that if you're from Florida, and especially if you're from this area, you'll recognize a lot of stuff. There's a lot of Easter eggs for a Floridian.
Yeah.
This movie it has a whole nother level of an enjoyment, or if you can despise it if you're from there, but there's definitely something going on with Floridians. And this movie won a big Florida, it won the Orange Award with the Florida Film Critic.
Yeah, I saw that in my
research. Yeah.
The contrast of sight to sound, too, is interesting. I know there's not a lot to do on sound, but if you consider dialogue sound with throwaway characters for the most part, like Mike said, this movie is shot in a way that, you know, it's this fantasy land from the kids' perspective, and it's this beautiful, lush, all these exotic-looking buildings and whatnot. And then when you hear the adults speak, like, you're reminded every minute pretty much throughout this movie what hell this place is. Like, this is hell on earth. There's a couple that comes in that's supposed to have their honeymoon in the Magic Kingdom.
Oh, I love that scene.
It's a great scene. And they get booked here by mistake. And the wife is flipping out because she says she doesn't want to stay here.
Right.
And the husband's trying to fix it and trying to get a reservation. And they're shitting all over the place that these people have to live in.
I love the fact that you got helicopters flying over from some of the real hotels, flying over to Disney World. And so, the proximity to Disney World, they do mention that she'll never get hired by anyone in the park.
Yes.
When she's looking for jobs and meeting with the unemployment agency and getting her food stamps. And however, I will say that the first half of the movie is kind of ignorant of all the reality in the sense of the chase for her next rent payment. It doesn't focus on that. And the second half of the movie is kind of more from the mother's, at least involves the mother's perspective a little more how she's paying for things.
I don't disagree at all. I felt the first half of the movie, and I have it written down here, I think the first 49 minutes, 52 minutes, something like that. You're not given really a through line. There's no story thread to follow, at least outside of the kids are going on adventures in this, what they see as a wonderland, but they're so hopefully naive to the reality of the situation because they're just so young.
Baker mentioned that front and center to a lot of his interviews, and he didn't want it to be like this conventional story in a Hollywood sense. He wanted you to feel like you're just spending the summer with these kids and with these people. And it has almost a documentary feel at times, even though the visuals are just totally different than what you get with a documentary. I guess jump into the performances now. You ready with the
production? Let's do some performance work again. So I guess, the elephant in the room is Dafoe being so heralded for his work here, and we both kind of have a problem with it.
He definitely wins the award for worst job ever. That's for sure. But so, it is a strong performance. He only gets emotional once,
though,
in this movie.
That's the problem I have with it.
Like, he has one scene where he really goes off. That's going to be my best scene that I'm going to talk about in spoilers. But
that's
otherwise,
the problem
it's a reserved.
I mean, it's very reserved. But at the same time, I don't know if it's because he's so emotionally numb at this point from dealing with these people. And I refer to him as Handyman Jesus in jest, but that's kind of what he is. He's Mr. Fix-It around the motel property, but he also has to not only look out for the property itself, he's kind of the adopted father of these kids to an extent.
It's cool that he's wrestling with his paternal instincts, not only for the kids, but for the young adults who are these, must have gave birth to these kids when they were 15.
Right.
Like Sean Baker says about
Rhea. He's a stand-in father, he's a stand-in husband. It would have been nice to see exhaustion, maybe, or some kind of human emotion outside of this is just how it is. I mean, it was a
reserve
performance,
Willem Dafoe,
like you said.
I wish you could have gone back home with Willem Dafoe. Yeah, seen
something.
Where he lives.
Yeah.
Seen him and Caleb Landry-Jones have another scene together.
Yeah, are we giving him this much praise because his performance was that good, or are we giving him this much praise because the subject matter sucks so much and it's nice to have a light shined on it?
It could be one of those career pats on the back. It could be one of those lifetime achievement awards if he gets it. I don't know. It's again, it's a small, it's a category this year that's soft.
And it is, and we've said that since episode one. We think best supporting actor is probably. Now that said, there's some good performances. Right. I mean,
but there's no obvious favorite. There's no Viola Davis in this category that's going to obviously win.
There's not. But I mean, is this better than Sam Rockwell in Three Billboards? Is it better? Is it better than Jenkins in Shape of Water? Is it even better than Bradley Whitford in Get Out?
Yeah, is it better than Patrick Stewart and Logan, right, like we were talking about yet last night?
Michael Shannon in Shape of Water, who's not getting any momentum from the supporting
actor? It almost feels to me like the field comes back to all these other names that we're not talking about. Never mind the guys from Mudbound, the guys from Detroit, the guys, like you said, from Get Out, the rest of that cast. You know, it almost opens up the field, and it's weird that the field is kind of condensing on Defoe and Rockwell and obviously Hammer, like I feel.
I mean, my leader is Hammer, like you just said. He's my leader right now, and we're going to get into it at some point in the future. But I think the performance by and Call Me by Your Name by Armie Hammer is just leaps and bounds. But it's also it demanded more. This was
now. I will say that balancing act that I mentioned in the opening, where the guy's trying to have his paternal instincts kind of squashed, and he's trying to do his job, right? You could see that Defoe's wrestling with those things.
Yeah, he's walking a tightrope. There's no doubt.
In the big scene that everybody talks about is the big scene, we'll get into spoilers, where he kind of sees a creepy-looking guy hanging around the kids. That scene in particular, he's balancing a lot, and he's showing it. There's another scene where he gets into a clash with another visitor to the motel, and then that turns into a clash with one of the occupants, one of the main characters in the movie. So he does have some good scenes.
Yeah, let's put a bow on this. I mean, I hate when there's podcasts and people who aren't in the industry at all, and obviously we're on the outskirts of the outskirts of it, but I hate when people just shit on performances and shit on movies. And
yeah.
We're not saying that. I mean, this is a great movie. It's a good performance, but it's just in the context of the Oscars and that category alone.
Right, right.
I think when you're dealing with something that should be so revered and so happy, think of Frances McDormand or Laurie Metcalf performance this year. Those are the types that you can see.
Allison Janney.
Yeah, they would be nominated in any other year.
Correct.
I don't think this one would.
I will say a feather in his cap is that he's dealing with the non-actors. It's not something that every thespian can
do. It's a good
point. With these guys, with their process of being in a theater company for 30 years or 40 years, like I said, this movie reminds me of my film student days of studying Vittorio De Sica's The Bicycle Thief. It's wild because Sean Baker kind of just goes to a town and brings people that live there into his movie, just like De Sica went to an Italian village and just started filming people. It's like, all right, you're going to star in my movie. So, you know, this film captures the indie spirit better than anything, I would think. I guess we can move into more of the lead performances.
Yeah, we could talk about those.
What'd you think of the mother, Bria Venaita?
I want to hear you say her name a couple thousand more times.
Name.
She was really good. I mean, I hate describing a performance as good, but you know, it wasn't great. It wasn't blow me away. It wasn't one of the best performances of the year I saw. But to play a drug-addled, I guess she doesn't really do drugs at all in this movie, does she?
No, we don't know. Maybe she. I thought there was a hint at one point when I watched it that she was recovering.
She's certainly a woman with her issues, and she does some clearly reprehensible things. This movie, we're going to get into whether it's a watch or must watch, but this movie is a must watch for any of your Republican friends that truly believe that everybody starts from the same place in life and everyone is capable of forging their own path and is open to the same opportunities.
Yeah, we don't try to hide our politics. We're honest with you. I mean, we do vote blue, but this would be something that we would push in front of you, and they pushed it in front of Congress. But yeah, but to get back to Bria Venaita, I loved her emotional scenes. I'm really glad that Sean Baker had her improvise so much. Like every scene with her outdoors with those kids, like playing in the rain underneath the fireworks. Yeah. I mean, she does such a great job, and it's like those kids are just having fun with her. And it's very genuine. Maybe that's something you can only get with a non-actor, where the actors are trying to do too much. They're trying to emote too much. It looks like they're just having a blast. But she does have some awkward scenes, I will say. It is kind of obvious to me when Sean Baker's feeding her a line. And it's obvious to me when he's doing that with the kids, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, you went in right into the Vanita performance, and she obviously is the lead. And if the kids don't have the POV for the majority of this movie, it's usually either her or Willem
Dafoe.
She's kind of
got the second half.
Yeah.
Well, she at the end of Act Two, she's got that, which is very smart writing, because when the bad guys are closing in, when the antagonism is turning up to 11, you kind of give that second act to the villain. And I'm not saying she's the villain, but her actions kind of go against her daughter at some point.
Yeah.
Even though there's not one scene where she is abusive to her daughter, unless you say that negligence is kind of abusive.
She's certainly mentally abusive.
I mean, I don't think she's really...
Swimsuit selfies?
Well, but that's like something that they're both happy about. And you can argue...
Well, I guess it's what's your definition of abuse?
She's not putting those pictures online of her daughter. Those are just her and her daughter taking pictures of one another.
Suffice to say, I don't think I agree with your take, but that's fine.
Listen, she's an awful parent and negligent, and you're probably right. Having her daughter exposed to the things she's exposed to is just negligence to the point of, it's a nightmare scenario. But what I'm trying to say is it's very obvious she loves her daughter and cares for her daughter throughout this movie. And it's one of those
weird...
Yeah,
she loves and cares for her, but at the same time, she is not willing to be an authoritarian figure at all.
No, she's like her buddy. Yeah. And that's like, the quintessential parent trap.
Instead,
I mean, we don't have kids of our own, but we're both the sons of great parents,
right.
You know, and we're in families surrounded by relatives who are great parents.
At times. Yeah,
I mean, I'm the oldest of five boys in my family, so I know what good parenting looks like. This is the worst. We work with kids today still, and this is the worst parenting job ever, in our opinion. And I can't help but just cringe throughout this movie when that stuff is happening. So it is tough to watch.
Put a pin in your. We'll bring this back up in spoilers about the abusive part, because I do want to hone in on something.
Brooklyn Prince, what did you think of her performance?
I thought she was the best performer. If Sean Baker's directorial job isn't a performance, I thought Brooklyn Prince was the best performer in this movie.
Yeah, again, I like. There's more than one scene where it's so obvious to me that Sean Baker's feeding her lines, and
she's 7-8 year old kid.
Again, it's one of those things where she's good for a child actor, but for an acting performance, it took me out of the movie several times. I took points off for it.
There's one scene where it's my worst scene as well. It's solely on her shoulders. So yeah, you don't have a child star that should be nominated for anything.
However, in terms of like kids awards, like best young performance,
right.
I totally believe that.
Yeah.
I mean, she has her highs in this movie are extraordinary.
Yes.
Like what she pulls off. And at the same time, again, the improvisation, the obvious improvisation of these scenes where they're having fun, you know, give that acting coach every award going, or give her all the work she can possibly get, because that she's like a co-director in this film, how she manages all these non-actors to do great stuff.
And it's a credit to obviously that coach and Baker and Prince, in that your first exposure to the Mooney character is like an unruly child, and it's someone who you're like, man, where are her parents? What is she doing? Who's allowing her to act like this? But yet still throughout the film, you grow enough of an emotional attachment to her that your heart breaks when you see what she goes through and what she's forced to do just to survive with her mother on a daily basis to just get rent money, for Christ's sake.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a great job by her, I think.
So that's the kind of the non-spoiler review of the performances. Do we want to punch any final thoughts before we give it a watch or don't watch?
No, I'm good. I definitely want to hit the abusive part back early in the spoiler section, so be on the lookout for that. But what'd you think? Watch, don't watch?
I just want to remind the folks, I think this is the quintessential indie film of the year. So if you like supporting those types of movies, it's an issue movie that has a lot of clarity to it. But it doesn't, even though it's an issue movie, it doesn't like just stand on its soapbox the whole time, I don't think. So
no, it's a spotlight. It's not a megaphone.
Yeah, the movie has some incredible moments to it. To me, it is a watch. It has a lot of merits. It's almost like I gave it a lot of points up, and then I took a lot of points off, and it kind of is a balancing act, and where it winds up in my grade is interesting. So we'll talk about that in spoilers. So watch this and come back to our show and listen to the spoiler stuff.
Is it okay if I give it a watch or don't watch first?
No. You're not allowed to speak anymore. Yeah, by all means, please.
I feel like I've been, I might be
I'm
higher
a bad
on this.
Host. That's why he does that stuff.
Yeah, I might be higher on this than you are when it comes to grades, but at the same time, I don't think I'm going to, I mean, it's a fantastic movie, but you need to be prepared for it. So I don't think this is a casual watch. I don't think you can just pick this up and to kill time for 2 hours, and it's so enrapturing. You can't be doing anything else when this movie's on, and right. when you're into it, you're going to feel gross at times. So you need to be okay with that. If you're not okay, first of all, if you can't commiserate with other people being less fortunate than you,
right.
you probably should watch this because it exists. But
if you're a parent too, like this movie may just freak you the hell out. And I don't know. I like we're not parents, so we don't know. We don't want to put extra stress on all you new parents out there or old parents out there that have to, you know, want to escape from your parenting life. And you don't watch this movie if you're going to do that.
You gotta be prepared. I mean, I give it a cautious watch. I think it's a great movie. That's not to say anything about the movie or the production of it. I think it's a fantastic movie, but just be wary traversing this land.
Get ready to dance, though.
Yeah,
now.
Let's hit the spoiler music. Spoilers ahead!
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike, and Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
All right, welcome back to the spoiler section now of the Florida Project. This is Mike, and Oscar giving you everything you need to know about the ins and outs and the ends of the storylines of the Florida Project. If you want to know anything about production profiles, performances, box office, specs of the movie, awards profiles, that's all in the first half of this profile. Go ahead and back and listen to the first 40 or so minutes if you don't want this movie ruined for you or hear about what happens at the end. If you've seen it and want to hear our thoughts about the ending, or if you haven't seen it or just curious to know what happens at the end of this movie, you're in the right place. But if not, like we said, go back and listen to the first part of this podcast, first 40 or so minutes, and we'll give you everything you need to know. But for the spoiler section, let's get into it. Let's talk about the abusive. Now, you said in the non-spoiler part that you don't feel like her mother, that Mooney's mother, is abusive.
She's definitely not verbally abusive to the child. So I would say that's one
that's
thing.
Fair.
I mean, by negligence, you're probably right. So maybe I'll backtrack that a little bit. She's probably negligent, and that constitutes abuse. I mean, listen, I'm cheering for the fact when child services take this kid away. I mean,
which is your natural instinct.
That's
right,
that's my feeling. So maybe I'm not articulating it properly. But so what do you specifically think is abuse in this movie?
Well, here's where I'm coming from with it and why I wanted to bring it up is that I worked in the courthouse and I worked in the family division family support magistrate division for a couple of a year or so. And if this, the whole time, especially provide context again in the movie, Bria Venita, Haley character, is throughout the movie trying to find ways to come up with rent for her and her daughter to live in the same motel room, and she finally eventually goes from selling cologne in on the back market to sex, and she's basically whoring herself out on
the kids in the bathroom. That was a great turn. You know, the kid taking a bath, and she's
and
got Johns in the other room.
Yeah, there's a
the
scene.
The music is blaring, so it's not like the kid is just completely.
But that, you know, if
oblivious to it. But
if you're in a courtroom and you hear the things that she's doing in exposing this child to, who's only 7 or 8 years old, something like that. I mean, it is reprehensible, and I can't imagine there's a judge on earth that wouldn't deem what she's put the kid through in some form of mental abuse, because you're putting your child at such a disadvantage so early in life.
Now, she's doing what she has to survive. And I would say on the other end, even though I'm not a lawyer, I would say that it's very empathetic, the portrayal of her in this movie, because she is basically shown to put the daughter and make the daughter, not only the daughter, but the daughter's surrogate, the audience, completely, you know, ignorant of what she's doing on the side. Like, we get some glimpses.
In some
but
aspects,
daughter has no idea her mom's a hooker.
No, she doesn't. But one, she's hookering with the child in the fucking motel. And the John actually sees Mooney taking a bath at one point when he goes in to take a piss.
By accident. Yeah.
Haley flips out when he gets in.
The line is that the bathroom was off limits. The mother was angry about
it. But at the same time, I mean, she's teaching her child pretty much unethical things. Yes, she's doing it to survive, but she's teaching her to beg for food, to hustle her ass off, which isn't a negative property in and of itself. Right. But to do it at such a young age, to teach your child that this is the only way to make money to survive is kind of, you know,
she uses the kid as an accomplice in the black market.
Yeah. It's unethical and immoral.
It's unethical. It is immoral. Again, she's not verbally abusive to the child. She does care and seemingly love the kid. She's not physically abusive
but
to the kid.
I think your you're rooting for DCF to take the kid away at the end, it's the right thing to do.
It's basically a result of everything you've said.
Yeah, it's what you want to happen.
It's so still a bad parent. Good God.
Wanted to wrap that up.
She's a great mom. No, I'm not saying that.
Here's your award. So let's get into best and worst scene. What did you have for your best scene of this movie?
My best scene is twofold, actually building on what you just said with that John who walked in on the kid in the bathroom by accident. So Willem Dafoe is the hotel manager again. He comes to the door when this guy's just banging on her door because she stole his Disney Park passes, right?
Yes.
From his bag and then sold them to somebody else for $400, kind of to
pennies
make rent,
on the dollar,
right?
Yeah.
$1,700 worth that the guy mentions. And that, by the way, that's the director of I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, the director of
No Kidding.
You know, yeah, he's an indie film director. He's awesome.
Cool.
Blue Ruin? Yes, Blue Ruin.
His name?
I forget his name, but he's an awesome actor and an awesome director. So in that scene, Willem Dafoe comes to her rescue.
Macon Blair was the name of the actor.
Macon Blair, yes, that's Macon Blair. In the scene, Willem Dafoe comes to Bria Venita's rescue there because this John is banging on the door. He's not leaving without an answer, without calling the police necessarily. But then again, it's a great scene because Bria Venita has some of her best acting in the movie. But it's also a great scene because the writing is awesome. You have a turn in the middle of that scene that goes from Willem Dafoe, rescuing her from this John, coming back with a vengeance, to the mom, Haley, and Willem Dafoe just going at it, tooth and nail, screaming at one another. That really worked, in my opinion. He's retreating to
and it results in like the worst version of an Aaron Sorkin walk and talk in the history of cinema.
But it's just electric.
Yes.
What's going on?
Totally.
And
agree.
Dafoe actually gets to the lobby where she's chasing him and screaming at him, and he can't help it. He screams back at her, and I just love that scene so much. And this might win him the Oscar because he screams, "Get out!" Right? He should have been in another movie we're talking about later today in our recording series. But he's screaming, "Get out!" at her, and then he pulls back. And he knew at the time he meant, "Get out of my motel." But then he pulls back. He's like, "Get out of the lobby. You know, get out of this lobby. You have 3 seconds."
Really, really
and that's an amazing thing. You could see it on his face that he pulls back.
Really
and
well
he does
analyzed.
He does the Green Goblin and screams. And then he pulls back, and he actually allows her to save face.
And it shows the respect both characters had for one another because he pulls back. He knows if he kicks her out, she's got nowhere to go, and he's basically putting Mooney to the curb.
Right.
And he has no recourse. He says, "If you don't get out of here," and he has nothing to follow it up with.
Right.
And then he's like, "But you need to get out on three, one, two," and
she does
leaps.
Leave. Then obviously she sticks her tampon on the window. That was gross, but he allows that to happen without completely throwing these people out on the street.
Yeah, it was interesting.
For the character and for him, I thought they did a great job.
It was interesting to see Haley react in a way where she actually listens to authority for literally the first time in the movie.
Right.
I mean, it was reluctant and she pushed it all the way to the edge, but she knows that she kind of needs Bobby's care in this movie. So that's a really well done scene. I also had as the best scene before that, Mooney meeting the John seeing Mooney and Mooney.
That revelation was
drawing the curtain close and just staring down.
It surprised me the first time I saw it. I did not think that all the bath time was mom, in the
I didn't
room
either. Yeah.
They pulled off that reversal and thinking back, like how did they pull that one over on me? But they did. I mean, if anything, again, the ignorance is bliss nature of this, that it feels like a childhood adventure. You're not completely overwhelmed with the poverty. You see it and you cringe at it. You see it and it hurts a little bit, but you're mostly in the POV of these kids throughout the movie. You know that their mischief is stuff that's
just absurd negligence. Yeah, and whatnot,
they don't know how bad they have it, but we as the audience do. Whether the adults, some of the adults do and some don't. But at the same time, that juxtaposition is never better shown. And I think this is my favorite scene in the whole movie. I had a couple of favorite scenes, but that juxtaposition for me is never better shown. You have this sequence where Haley and Mooney are selling the cologne in the parking lot. They get caught by the security guard of the country club. The country club, because I called the cops already, have to come. They keep trying to leave.
Yep.
The cologne ends up getting unspilt on the floor, and the security guard takes it. So Mooney and Haley just walk off. They're not going to be talked to by the cops.
She can't get arrested again, she says.
They are walking too fast. They're walking on the side of the road back to the motel. Mooney can't walk anymore, so Haley puts her on her back, and this is all happening.
Right.
Haley says she can't get arrested again to her 7-year-old daughter, who puts that on her, and has to pick up her 7-year-old daughter's asking, why did that woman take our cologne? Mm-hmm. You know, and all this is happening. She ends up putting Mooney on her back in front of us, a highway sign that says Seven Dwarves Lane in 7 miles, you know, and it's reminding you that this is the happiest place on earth right down the road. And these people are just the juxtaposition in that scene I thought was so poetic, and it was such a driving of the nail of what the message of this movie was. It was so fucking sad.
Great points.
So heavy to take. I think that was my favorite scene of the movie.
I kind of follow that up with, again, the antagonism of her life choices, what she has to do. But they also follow it up with all the fun scenes, the scenes where the birthday
this is
fireworks.
The point you're making. I mean, the mother, Haley, does care about Mooney a lot. She loves this girl. As she does. This isn't Allison Janney's character.
Her composure on that last day where she sends the kid off with a great meal. That broke my heart.
Buffet, me too.
Because she's just she's totally composed. The most composed she's been. She knows DCF is coming to take her kid away that day.
So at this point in the movie, DCF has already visited Haley. They already told her she needs to basically clean up her act.
And she literally cleans up the apartment. She does. She's doing her best. She's throwing the Hail Mary, hoping that the kid can stay. She knows that she's not going to be able to. And this is up against the fact that she knows she's going to be homeless in a couple days, right?
Right.
So the courage of that character, how they write her in as being, you know, a heroic mom in many, many ways. So just the empathy for that character, again, despite all the shades of gray and black, if anything, that
it's amazing in a $2 million budget movie. I mean, she might be the most complex character we've dealt with in any movie.
Played by a non-actor?
Yeah. I mean, she does stuff. She played by an Instagram person. Right. You know, she does stuff that's so despicable and so unethical and so immoral. But at the same time, you know, on a human level, she, A, doesn't know any better, and B, is just trying to survive for her kid.
Baker talked about it in promotional videos that, listen, I mean, I could get some of the biggest actresses in the industry. They wanted to work with me after Tangerine, but I kept coming back to this Instagram girl that I thought was just going to bring something new and refreshing, and he went with the new and refreshing, and I can't believe they pulled this performance out of her, even though, again, there were some awkward scenes where it's obviously just kind of contrived.
It's not a perfect performance. It's not an award-winning performance, but it's certainly one of the more surprising performances and certainly one of the more complex and deep characters that we've had to study.
Okay, so the next big topic for me is worst scenes, and we're going to throw the ending out there with it because, for me, my worst scenes are the awkward ones, and it's more like moments than scenes, the awkward ones where the actors aren't doing the job. But your worst scene was the ending, and I want to talk about the ending because I have a begrudging respect for it. Like, I've seen a lot of these indie movies before, and I really like the fact that they ended it with such an artistic just take off and just went. They went for it with the iPhone again. That's his signature. That so the kids, after Brooklyn Pierce is crying at the door of her friends, who she goes to throughout the movie.
Her crying was tough for me to see. I thought it was heartbreaking, and it's certainly gives you an emotional attachment. But the
DCF is in the apartment.
She's in the midst of running away from the DCF agents.
Right.
She goes to her friend Jancy's, who's probably had the biggest transformation of any character in this movie throughout her arc. She went from
she's becoming an accomplice, though.
Right. She went to a silent doesn't want to do any wrong by her grandmother.
Her grandma's doing a good job, actually.
And Mooney kind of corrupts her, for lack of a better term, throughout the movie.
Going to other complexes and burning them down.
Right. Yeah, literally burning down a complex.
Yeah, the mischief is
an empty, a vacant motel.
Their escalation towards crime.
So she shows up at Jancy's front door, and Jancy, she's crying, wants Jancy to help her. She says, "You were my best friend." and Jancy grabs her by the hand, and then they're off. And the music starts up for the first time in the whole movie. And like Mike said, you have a shaky iPhone-type following shot as the girls are running, which is fitting. So at this point, you're still fitting in the movie because, again, Baker has shown throughout this movie that the kids are going on adventures. This is how POV, they kill time in the summer. They're going on what they think are these big adventures and what really is going across the street for ice cream.
Yep.
Except this time, they go all the way, and they make it to the Magic Kingdom.
And you got an iPhone stealing footage, really, and in the actuality of that, of the Magic Kingdom.
Of the kid, of the two girls running up to Disney. Cinderella's castle.
How did they get in? That's what did the they pay? Did they sneak in?
Okay. I have no problem with you having the balls to try that. For me, it was just underwhelming.
To me, it's about escapism. So that thematically, it meant something to me because this is something I deal with in my own life. You know, I don't face down my own problems. I escape into a million movies. And this is a movie telling me that our American answer to a lot of these real life problems is escapism. When the drama's at its height, we escape. We escape to Disneyland. If the quintessential version of escapism that is selling it the most, that is selling it the best, okay? And he goes and steals shots on the lot of the actual Disney World, and he has these kids run through to the Magic Kingdom. That level of notoriety, that iconic image of the Magic Kingdom being the end of this film, like we're escaping
to. Okay, so then if you're – but this is the same problem I have, and maybe it's a me problem. Why are we doing these one-off scenes that aren't threaded in at any other point throughout the – like, I understand your point with escapism, but the escapism that Mooney has up to that point is basically her iPad that her mother has to sell to make rent.
Right. I mean, listen, the proximity of the park
makes sense.
It's
the same problem I had with the dancing scene in Shape of Water.
It's a showy thing. It's a takeoff.
And I have no problem with the attempt. It didn't fit.
I think we're a good representation of the critical community right now because a lot of people like this movie despite that scene from the critics. And a lot of the critics love this scene and love the movie because of this scene. I kind of give it a clap because it just meant something to me thematically. I think you're justified in saying that you're right. They didn't really set it up. You got such beautiful visuals. You got such competent cinematography. And then you go the iPhone route. It's almost like it's very meta because it goes back to his signature and that he's the iPhone guy, right? But I guess...
Which I get, but I guess if you're going to do, if this is a fantasy scene, because again, the realistic, the logistical questions of how they get in the park, how they break in, you know, it has to be a fantasy
scene.
Baker
seemed in those interviews that, like, he thought it was a fantasy scene. He wanted to.
So that's, I mean, that's okay that you go iPhone in that route to me.
Right.
I mean, but I just as an ending, as putting the final touch on the movie. I don't know. It just didn't ring the bell for me.
Do you have to, again, it's like the Three Billboards problem. Do you have to see the kid get dragged away by DCF?
Right.
Or do you have to see the kid get away and somehow live as a vagrant for the next day or two before she gets caught?
Think about, we just talked about, the sequence leading up to that is the final breakfast, for lack of a better term.
Right.
And Haley knows Mooney's going to be taken by DCF, probably. The 15 minutes leading up to it, you're on the edge of your seat because you're like, what's going to happen with this girl? She's taking life in her own hands. She's running away, and the DCF doesn't know where she is at this point.
The people I watched it with thought she was going to get hit by a car.
So did I! I thought either she was going to get hit by a car or I thought Haley was going to hang herself.
Ugh.
Because you see Haley take that shirt and go disappear in the bathroom.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting and kind of, again, heartbreaking that she only goes off after she knows the kid is missing, you know, and she goes off on the cops. Like, she was totally reserved, totally cooperating until, you know, the DCF woman comes and says, your daughter's run away. And she's like, I'm the irresponsible one. Then she blows up. But before that, she's like, I'm not going to help you take my kid away.
Right.
I thought that was just so poignant.
That was a great
line. And she pulls it off. And I thought that sequence was you have to engage it. That's all I'll say. So it's one of those things. I think it's a mark of a good indie movie. Like, it's going to affect you. That final sequence with the DCF and then the final sequence with them running away. So I like the balls of that. But like you said, I can agree with the fact that it wasn't foreshadowed. You're right.
It's a bit akin to the ending in They Look Like People, which is on Netflix. It's kind of an indie horror, supernatural thriller type deal. It's, you know, it's kind of what you believe. The ending could be fantasized. It could be in your own head. It could not. For me, in something like They Look Like People, it worked. In something like this, in The Florida Project, I just thought it lost points.
It screams art film. It screams indie film. I kind of liked it.
So let's wrap this baby up. Let's go right into grades and see what we have for the ending of this after we just kind of, you know, pooped on the ending for me.
Well, I liked it, but we're a cross-section of the critics. I think half of them like it, half of them don't.
And I have a grade that that reflects that I really like this movie overall. So wow. The ending didn't lose many points for me. So what'd you have for a grade for this?
I have a B+88. I think it's a strong movie. It's not
quite... High five me.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That's the first time we had the same grade.
No, it's the second time. We had three billboards, I think. Anyway, but yeah, it's rare that that happens.
Yeah, I'd never. Very rare. Yeah, that was the exact same grade I gave.
Episode as well. Even yeah. Still. But it's one of those movies that you have
what
to engage
with. What a twist ending. M. Night Shyamalan would be proud of this podcast.
I add points for its independent film spirit. I add points with some of the performance that they're able to get. Obviously, Willem Dafoe is strong, but it was underwhelming for me still. I take some points off for the awkward acting at times. Again, dollar for dollar, you would probably rate this like as an A+.
Yeah, this is the Floyd Mayweather Jr. of, you know, like the pound for pound of this movie. It's outstanding.
We're talking about the Oscars, so we do say that, you know, we do put them all on the same playing field, and this, you know, it's
whether
like Yankees
or unfairly,
versus
yeah.
A's. Yep. Somebody's got to win. So I do think it's a strong B+. It's definitely watchable. So what did you think? What a final thought there, Mike.
Yeah, we just high-fived over it. So I had this exact same outcome as you, 88 B+, very strong. Feel the same about Dafoe. We disagree about the ending, but we were able to disagree civilly as opposed to a Harry and Tonto, where I banned Mike from my house for a couple weeks.
Shape of Water was a pretty good argument, too.
Yeah. That's the thing about these scenes, these movies in this Oscar season. There's a lot of bad people and bad characters and bad setups for these Oscar movies that have come out this year.
My
and,
word has been abrasive. I don't think that's a great word, but...
But you've been making the point that is the Academy going to embrace these horrible, horrible people for these things? Are they going to take the half, are they going to take the half measures? It's going to be interesting to see. I'd rather see this movie get directorial credit and get Best Picture credit than I would for Willem Dafoe.
Back to the Academy, though, if it's the same old Academy, then something like Driving Miss Daisy will win. Some kind of compromise candidate will win at the end of the day. I don't know if that's going to happen. I think last year's Moonlight win could give us some hope that something unique, that a unique voice can take it. But
I thought La La Land won.
Yeah, right.
So, I stopped watching after Faye Dunaway talked.
Yeah, I mean, not that I didn't want La La Land to win. I did at that point because Moonlight was so worthy that you can't begrudge the win. I gave that a 89 B+, 98 minus at the time.
And it's an interesting, I mean, you know, last year at this time, I think we were all talking La La Land a heavy favorite. Maybe Moonlight could be Best Picture. This year, I have no idea. It's so up in the air.
The Oscars, as Feinberg always says, they tend to go more independent film than blockbuster.
Yes.
And Hollywood Foreign Press goes more blockbuster. So it's going to be interesting to see what the Oscars do if something like this, and if someone like Sean Baker becomes an Oscar favorite, at least one of their niche favorites going forward that's undeniably talented that they have to nominate.
I think if Baker finds himself in the directorial category for the Oscars when the nominations are released on Tuesday, January 23rd, that's going to be a huge victory for this movie.
Oh, monstrous.
I mean, monster. In the year of all the directors that we have, it's going to be a huge victory.
It hasn't done well in terms of box office. So if it does get nominations, it's going to get a second life. That's why, again, it's kind of lingering in theaters. Now, we do recommend seeing it if you're in the right frame of mind.
Yes. But yeah, one of the stronger movies for the year for both of us so far. Right. And we'll see. I mean, there's the argument to be made. Defoe's, again, going to be the hardware winner most likely for his category. And based on this performance, is it because of the content of the movie or is it because of his actual performance?
You know what?
There's a lot to be argued
about.
He
was the draw. That's what I'll say. Oh, yeah. He's the draw. Like when I went to watch this movie, he's the draw and he's kind of the focus of the podcast and our podcast in many ways today. However, Sean Baker's filmmaking style, the visuals of this movie, the unique story that it's telling,
and
winds
the unique
up being,
story that it actually the unique story Inception, I mean, an Instagram model, a young kid, you know, I mean, that are pulling their weight for the most part.
Fascinating stuff. So thanks for listening again. We really appreciate, you know, all you comeback listeners, that you guys have been consistent. Every episode we're putting out is getting those hits, and
we can't
we really appreciate
all
it.
Of you enough. We love you guys. We appreciate it. We love the comments. We love talking to you guys. Seriously, I mean, if you have any thought about any movie at all and you want to try to get at us and let us know, We do our best to respond to absolutely everything, and I'm usually spending many nights alone on Twitter, just in a fetal position. No,
you're working your butt off. I pat you on the back. I mean, you're doing a great job.
Don't
with all
pat
the technical
too hard.
Side.
I got a bad back.
We had four recordings over the last like 9 days or something.
You've
like
been
that.
Burning it.
Five
yeah.
recordings over the last 2 weeks. Six recordings.
Which is amazing.
Amazing.
When we started this, we had like one recording over the first 3 months.
We're getting our reps, but we're trying to work hard for you guys. So again, you know, if you can help us out, tell a few friends, give us a few clicks here and there to spread the word, that would really help. We think we got a good backlog of episodes for folks to look at on demand, to look at in order and sequence, whatever you like to do. Check these episodes out.
And we're here. We're priding ourselves on being hopefully your go-to spot for everything you need to know about the Oscars and award season in general. Reach out to us. Let us know your thoughts. Let us know how you think we're doing. Let us know how you feel about these films. We're Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook. Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram. MMO_pod on Twitter. And Mike, Mike, and Oscar @gmail.com. Hit us up. Let us know.
Talk to us.
Yeah. Reality sucks, guys. Keep watching movies with us, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.